Our first scripture reading is from Exodus chapter 20. Listen to these 8 words of God. Then God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the waters under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. You shall not make wrongful use of the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not acquit anyone who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, but rested the 7th day. Therefore the Lord blessed the 7th day and consecrated it. Honor your father and mother, so that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God has given you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal.
Our second lesson this morning comes from the Gospel of Matthew, the 20th chapter. Let us listen to this story that Jesus told his disciples and the crowds around him. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for the usual daily wage, he sent them into his vineyard. When he went out about 9 o'clock, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and he said to them, "You also go into the vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right." So they went. When he went out again about noon and about 3 o'clock, he did the same thing. And about 5 o'clock, he went out and found others standing around, and he said to them, "Why are you standing here idle all day?" They said to him, "Because no one has hired us." He said to them, "You also go into the vineyard." When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his manager, "Call the laborers and give them their pay, beginning with the last and then going to the first." When those hired about 5 o'clock came, each of them received the usual daily wage. Now when the first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received the usual daily wage. And when they received it, they grumbled against the landowner, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for the usual daily wage? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last the same as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or are you envious because I am generous?" So the last will be first, and the first will be last. This is the word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
As you know, we've been spending our summer Sundays with the Ten Commandments, also known as the Decalogue, or the Ten Words, that most basic set of rules for living that many of us learned a long time ago in Sunday school or catechism or confirmation class. We chose this focus for the summer for 2 reasons. The first was that our theme this year is life in the neighborhood, and we have been learning about what it means to build and live in a neighborhood in God's kingdom, a neighborhood that makes real God's vision for community, a neighborhood in which all life is valued and uplifted as God intends. The Ten Commandments provide us with the perfect foundation of our life together in God's neighborhood. The second reason for our focus is that in spite of our insistence on our nation's Christian foundation and all of the protests that erupt whenever anyone suggests removing inscriptions of the Ten Commandments from a public place, the vast majority of Americans do not even know what they are, much less live by them. Although by one count, there are over 4,000 public displays of the Ten Commandments in the United States, less than 10% of Americans can identify more than 4 of the 10 at any given time. No wonder so many people accuse Christians today of hypocrisy, A lot of us don't even know or follow our own rules. This is a great reason to take that Ten Commandments challenge that I mentioned in the email this week. See if you can memorize the Ten Commandments, make a video of yourself, and send them to us at techteam@fpcyorktown.org. We would like to create a montage in a few weeks from now. Now, when it comes to actually following the Ten Commandments, I think most of us put the commandments in one of two categories. Either, that's no problem, I wouldn't do that anyway. Or, I'm not really sure what that commandment even means, so it probably doesn't apply to me. Take, for example, you shall not murder or kill. Most of us would say, no problem, that's easy. I haven't killed anyone today, I'm not planning to, and we can check that off our list. But how about you shall not make for yourself an idol? What is an idol? If I don't have any or worship any statues of strange gods at my house, does this even apply to me? Or how about misusing God's name? Good Lord, my God, Jesus Christ, everybody does it. So it must not be very important anymore. Or how about honoring the Sabbath? With stores open 24/7, in person or online, and people working from anywhere at any time, day or night, our daily life and our weekly schedules are no longer organized around a Sabbath anymore. So that one must not apply either. So you see, either we take the commandment so literally and individually that it's easy to say we kept it, or we assume that it's no longer relevant, and we let ourselves off the hook from following it or even paying any attention to it. So where do we find ourselves today, then, with the eighth commandment, you shall not steal? I would imagine that for most of us, if we interpret this commandment at its most literal and individual, we can all feel pretty good about ourselves. We haven't robbed a bank lately, or even shoplifted at the grocery store. We haven't cheated on our income taxes, forgotten to return our neighbor's top quality garden tools, or cut corners at work to avoid certain regulations. But what happens when we take a closer look at the Eighth Commandment, about what it meant to the first people who received it, and what it means to us when we expand our understanding to include the whole community and the basic principles underneath it? In the Bible, stealing is much more than an individual sin involving someone else's property. Stealing is a social sin that impacts not only the victim and the thief, but the bonds of trust and responsibility that are essential for the well-being of the whole community. This biblical understanding of stealing begins with the very simple belief that as Psalm 24 proclaims, the earth and everything in it belongs to God. Everything we are and have, whether it's air, the air we breathe, our food we eat, clothing, our shelter, the work we do, the money we spend, it's all a gift from our Creator and the source of our lives. We are stewards of God's gifts, not the owners. This core belief has a profound impact on the community that God called the Hebrew people to be. As Eugenia Gamble explains in her Bible study on the Decalogue, Love Carved in Stone, personal property was important, but it was never exactly personal. Everything belonged to God. Everything we had was a gift from God and was to be used to further God's ends alone. Wealth was to be used for the good of the community as a whole. In the biblical worldview, because everything belongs to God, private property is never really seen as personal possession. It is an entrusted thing for which we have responsibility, but not ownership. If all of life is a gift meant to be used for the good of all, then stealing something from somebody else was, in effect, taking something that God had given to them to steward, to use and to manage for the good, not just of themselves, but of the whole community. In this way, stealing not only did wrong to the victim of the theft, but to the whole community, and was in essence stealing from God himself. It broke the bonds of trust between people in the community, and the bond of trust in God as the ultimate provider of everything that we need to survive and to thrive. Notice that this commandment does not have a direct object. You shall not steal, period. It doesn't define specifically what we are not supposed to steal. This word is wide open so that it can include any and everything, and so defy our tendency to boil the commandment down into something simplistic and easy to manipulate for our own well-being. God gave the Israelites the Ten Commandments as the overarching principles for their life in community. And then God gave them another 603 commandments in the Torah to help explain exactly what those first 10 commandments meant and looked like in daily life. So there are lots of other commandments in the Torah that define more explicitly all the different kinds of stealing and their consequences, as well as some other guidelines that we might not initially connect to this commandment. For example, if you stole somebody's donkey or sheep, their cloak or their millstone, their olives or their grain, you would be required to pay restitution in the amount of 4 to 5 times what you stole. The punishment for stealing material goods was always aimed at restitution and restoration of relationships. Because life was considered so sacred, however, stealing a person, whether by kidnapping or enslavement, was so unacceptable that it was punishable by death. If someone had to indenture themselves or their family members to pay off their debts, Jewish law required the freeing of all slaves every 7 years. Slavery was not meant to be a permanent status for anyone. There are many other commandments about not using false weights and measures to cheat people in the marketplace, about paying people fairly and in a timely manner, and about not exploiting workers or your neighbors. Failure to do any of these things was considered stealing because you were depriving others of their livelihood and their ability to provide for their families. Charging interest on a loan to someone in the community was forbidden because if someone needed a loan, they were clearly in economic distress. To profit from someone else's misfortune and increase the burden of their debt was considered a form of theft. Now, all Israelites were commanded to tithe or to give 10% of their harvest or wages to God. This reminded them that ultimately everything they had belonged to God, and the tithes of the community provided for those whose work or life circumstances prevented them from having what they needed to live. This included the priests, whose lives were devoted to the works of God, and the widows, orphans, immigrants, and the poor. As the prophet Malachi warned an affluent Israel, failure to tithe is robbing God of what God is due and what the community needs for the good of all within it. I found it especially fascinating that all of the rules about gleaning fall under the umbrella of this eighth commandment. Gleaning was the practice of leaving a portion of your crops in the fields, of not harvesting every last row of wheat, bunch of grapes, or basket of olives, so that the poor would be able to come and gather what they needed to survive. Failure to do so was stealing what the poor had a right to collect in order to live. Gleaning was not considered an act of charity, but an act of justice for the poor and the oppressed. As all of these examples illustrate, stealing was not just an individual act or issue, but a communal one. As Gamble explains, in the Bible, theft is always a social sin. The eighth word is about respect and responsibility for the good of the neighbor. For this reason, passive inaction is also forbidden. Not only must we not steal property from one another, we must not steal by failing to act in the community for the neighbor's good when their welfare is at risk. When a community is called to refuse to steal, it is also called to ensure the economic sufficiency of its neighbors. This commandment requires that the community address structures for the support of the economic needs of all. As Old Testament scholar Patrick Miller writes in his commentary on the Ten Commandments, the Eighth Commandment is not just a matter of general property rights, but of what human beings, a family, needs to support, to provide food and clothing. It creates a community that will watch for the economic endangerment of the other members of the community and not hide from it behind gated communities and the walling off, literally or figuratively, of the ghettos of the economically endangered. In fact, as Joan Chittister notes in her book on the Ten Commandments, which she calls the laws of our heart, Israel wrote laws not to protect the rich from the poor, who might steal from them, but to protect the poor from being exploited by the rich. In the hierarchy of commandments, stealing food to survive was understandable and forgivable since it was necessary to preserve life. But preventing others from the necessities of life when you had enough was the far greater sin. Now we begin to see and understand the bigger picture behind this commandment, that it's about a lot more than pocketing a pack of bubblegum or robbing a bank. There are much bigger, more encompassing principles or values that undergird the kind of community that God intends for human beings, the kind of neighborhoods we are called to build and inhabit. Values like trust and reliance on God alone for our well-being, rather than our own anxious striving and consuming. Values like love of our neighbor and even our strangers and our enemies. Compassion and generosity and justice for all, especially for those who are without the means to support themselves. Of course, the ancient Israelites weren't much better at keeping this commandment than we are today. As the prophets continually reminded them, they were straying from God's ways whenever they lived in big, comfortable houses and let the homeless wander the streets, whenever they exploited their workers or cheated people in the marketplace to cut corners and increase their own profits, whenever they gave God the leftovers, the seconds, their spare change, instead of the first fruits of their harvest and wealth and prosperity. Christians throughout the centuries have observed and wrestled with the implications of this commandment. Way back in the 4th century, early church father St. John Chrysostom declared, "Not to enable the poor to share in our goods is to steal from them and deprive them of life. The goods we possess are not ours, but theirs." In the Middle Ages and the Reformation, both St. Thomas Aquinas and John Calvin equated stealing with murder, basically because it involves stealing the means for someone else's livelihood. And in his own colorful way, Martin Luther begins with the assumption that the world is a system of thievery in which all the sins that possess us, thievery is the most common craft on earth. In his large catechism, he pronounced, "If we look at mankind and all its conditions, it is nothing but a vast, wide stable full of great thieves." As Gamble points out, we are certainly not unfamiliar with stealing today. The headlines are filled with it. Trusted money managers make off with their clients' life savings. Struggling youth rob a convenience store. Celebrities cheat and steal their way into colleges for their kids. Government employees pocket a box of paper clips or a ream of paper to use at home. And before we know it, these items total $6 million. Some of us may have downloaded copyrighted material, fudged a bit of it on our expense accounts, or failed to disclose all of our income to the IRS. In fact, this commandment against stealing and its commandment about lying, stay tuned for that next week, may well be the most difficult of all the commandments to keep in the midst of our practical daily living. As Willimon and Hauerwas argue, the most difficult commandments for us are these dealing with stealing and lying, because they cut to the heart of the deceit upon which our lives are built. We simply do not want to acknowledge that we are caught up in systems that make it impossible to discover how deeply implicated we are in theft and lying. So if we look beyond the obvious and the individual, where do we see this commandment violated today? When we would rather spend a few cents or dollars less on goods manufactured in sweatshops on the other side of the world where workers struggle to survive, instead of paying a bit more for a product from a company that pays their employees a living wage, we're stealing. When CEOs make 100 to over 1,000 times what the average worker in their company makes, the Bible calls that theft. When we throw away produce that doesn't look perfect or dispose of things that still have useful life in them, we are stealing. As Joan Chittister writes, to waste food or to give in to conspicuous consumption by throwing away something that still has value simply in order to get a new one is stealing from those who have need of such things but can't possibly afford to get them for themselves. When we give God whatever is left over, after we've paid the mortgage and the bills and for our home renovations and our new cars and furniture and electronics and our extracurricular and recreational activities and our vacations, whatever we don't really need to maintain our comfortable, privileged lives, we are robbing God and the rest of the world that goes to bed hungry or homeless or without much hope for the basic necessities of life. When the stock market keeps going up, companies keep earning record profits, and the top 10% of people own more wealth than the bottom 90% combined, when we live in a country where income inequality and the gap between rich and poor gets bigger and bigger, and yet we don't work for structural changes that provide for the good of all who live here, even the poor and the immigrant, then we are participating in systems that not only normalize, but necessitate theft and stealing to keep the status quo and the powerful in place. As Sister Joan writes, we cannot claim that we are not a nation of thieves until we insist on a society in which no one has to steal to live. All of this brings us to our second lesson for today, and I'm sure you thought I'd forgotten it by now, the parable of the workers in the vineyard. Although I'd hoped to spend more time on this parable, which has become one of my favorites, I'm going to boil it down quickly. This parable gets under our skin because it goes against all of our rules of fairness and getting paid for the work we do. Of course, we assume that we would have been among the earliest workers to be hired that day, and so deserve to be paid even more than what we agreed upon, since we did more work than those who started later than us. We are far more concerned about what we didn't get than the fact that all of the workers that day received the usual daily wage. Back in biblical times, the usual daily wage was calculated by local towns and villages to be the basic amount that any family needed to survive and take care of itself. Employers were expected to pay this rate to their employees as a matter of social justice so that everyone in the community would have enough to live on. The parable tells us that the reason that the workers hired later in the day couldn't find work was not through any fault or laziness of their own, but because there was no one to hire them. There wasn't enough work for them to do. So instead of advocating for their friends and neighbors and helping them find work earlier, or rejoicing at the end of the day that everyone had enough to feed their families that night, thanks to a just and generous landowner, the workers hired early in the day were upset that they didn't get more than they had agreed upon and more than they really needed. Give us this day our daily bread. We pray every Sunday when we say the Lord's Prayer together. Do we really mean daily? Are we satisfied with our daily bread? Or would we rather take more than we need, possibly even depriving others of what they need to assuage our insecurity and inability to trust in God as the source and provider of all that we need? In the end, this commandment is all about our perspective on life. Is it a gift? Or is it something I earned and deserve and own for myself? This commandment is also about the choices that we make in our daily living about what we give and what we take. Gamble says it best, At the heart of this word is the ultimate dignity of human life and the sacred bonds of respect that hold human community together. We may not take people's possessions from them, nor may we take from that which make a life of dignity possible. Keeping the eighth word creates an environment of dignity for all. It has to do with our choices, what our choices give to or take from others. When we keep this word, we consider another's well-being, self-esteem, ability to earn a living, sense of security, place in the community, honor and dignity to be precious and inviolable. We steal when we think some people are worthy and others are not. The hope at the heart of this word is that we will see each other as real, precious, and a part of the fabric of God's beloved creation. I don't know about you, but this commandment seems pretty relevant to life today and to our ministry and our mission as a church in God's neighborhood. May we live our lives trusting in God, our Creator, to give us all that we need so that we may give instead of take and share what we have with everyone. Amen.